This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue-collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue-collar workers for blue-collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. Outdoor Edge knows that providing a freezer full of meat is part of the reason we all hunt. And what better way to bring it full circle than to process your own wild game? Outdoor Edge provides a full lineup of traditional and replaceable blade hunting knives and complete wild game processing kits to bring your wild game from the field to the freezer. Visit OutdoorEdge.com and at checkout, enter the discount code NATION30 for 30% off.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Close your eyes, exhale, feel your body relax, and let go of whatever you're carrying today.
Well, I'm letting go of the worry that I wouldn't get my new contacts in time for this class. I got them delivered free from 1-800-CONTACTS. Oh my gosh, they're so fast.
And breathe.
Oh, sorry. I almost couldn't breathe when I saw the discount they gave me on my first order. Oh, sorry. Namaste.
Visit 1-800-CONTACTS.com today to save on your first order.
1-800-CONTACTS.
The Houndsman XP podcast is fueled by Joy Dog Food. Joy Dog Food has a rich tradition of supporting the Houndsman of America. Founded in 1945, Joy is proud of its history and the relationship it has built with the American Houndsman. And in 76 years, there's never been a recall. Made with 100% American-made high-quality ingredients, Joy Dog Food has one of the highest calorie-dense formulas on the market. For 76 years, this made-in-America product has kept hunting dogs in the field day after day, season after season. And when we say made-in-America, Joy has a long track record of fighting for American freedoms by being on the front lines against the animal rights movement and their extremist tactics. Joy will fuel your hounds and fight for your freedoms, fueled by Joy.
The
This is the Houndsman XP Podcast.
Good dog, get that bird. Get that bird in here.
The original podcast for the complete Houndsman. The podcast that represents our lifestyle of extreme performance.
Get up there!
Get him! Get him! Yeah, good boy!
Good boy, Ranger!
Uniting houndsmen across the globe, from east to west, north to south.
You know, if you're going to catch a cat or a lion, you know, you have to have teamwork.
We take you to the wildest places on earth.
Yeah, so how many days a week do you spend out there?
As much as I can, to be honest with you. Anytime that I get, I'm out there.
Join us for every heart-pounding adventure on Houndsman XP.
I'll tell you like I tell everyone else, I'm going to hunt whether you're here or not, so you might as well be here.
I was walking out with the hounds to get to a crossroads, and the hounds were probably 50 yards in front of me, and they all stopped. And they said, how come they stopped? I said, because they know they're waiting for me to cross that road. They said, well, why did they do it? I said, because I'm with them, and they know what I'm doing. And every one of them has got a name, and they all know the name.
On this episode of the Houndsman XP Podcast, we are going to take a trip, and our tour guide is Mr. John Broadhurst from Liverpool, England, originally. He now lives in the United States, but John was a professional huntsman and terrier man for the fox hunts in England, and he served in that capacity for decades, and he's willing to share all of the history of traditional hound work and terrier work, and how the two come together to create the traditional fox hunt in England. I met John at the American Hunting Terrier Association trials a few weeks ago in Somerset, Kentucky. And as I was making a round through the Southeast last month, then I stopped at Mr. John's house and interviewed him in person. To say that John is a hunting expert is an understatement. This guy is a fanatic. While I was there, I got to go through all of the old photo albums. I was amazed by the collection of hound hunting memorabilia he has, everything from classic paintings to bronze statues to actual hunting horns that were used in the fox hunt. John has also written two books. They are titled Terrier Men and Terriers, Volumes 1 and 2, and it is a deep dive into hunting terriers. There's a lot in this one, folks, but the best part is John shares his vast experiences and knowledge about hunting with hounds. The Old South Dog Box is rocking. Let's get the tailgate down. It's time to dump the box. Briar Creek Kennels is your complete hound hunting outfitter. Boots, lights, collars, and tracking equipment. Dog boxes, kennel supplies, collars, clothes, squalors. Whew, they have it all. Briar Creek Kennel is a Garmin and Dogtra dealer. Owner Chris Girth will ensure Briar Creek Kennel customers will get top of the industry customer service. Whether you purchase from their website or you find them at a major coonhound event, Chris and his staff will share expert knowledge and experience about every product they offer. Chris Girth is a top competitor and breeder of hounds. He knows what gear you need to be successful. Look for Briar Creek Kennels on the web for a complete online store, or look at their fully stocked trailer at any major coonhound event. Briar Creek Kennels, offering a hound hunting public generations of excellence. All right, we are rolling. Welcome to the Houndsman XP Podcast, everybody. We got a special treat for you this week, and
I met John Broadhurst in Somerset, Kentucky at the American Hunting Terrier trial here a couple weeks ago. And it just absolutely, John, you blew my socks off. When I started talking to you, you know, we go to those things, and when I got to the thing, you never know who you're going to meet. And I was introduced to you, and you are from England, and you were actually a huntsman over in England?
A professional huntsman.
Professional huntsman.
With a pack of beagles.
Becky Dwyer is going to want to listen to this. She's like, we call her the Beagle Queen over here in the United States. She runs lions with beagles and has started breeding beagle into their big game hounds and things like that out there with great success. So.
She probably done that for the nose.
Yeah.
For the beagle nose.
Yeah.
So before I went with beagles, I was a professional terrier man to two packs of foxhounds.
There are so many layers to you, John. We're not going to be able to unpack everything in one episode. I can tell you that. But you've written two books on terriers. And in those books, and I told you this off air, but I'm going to tell everybody right now that if you hunt with dogs, these are books that you should have on your shelf. They are collector's items. So tell us about the book. Let's just start out. Let's start out with talking about where you're from. Talk about John Broadhurst's story here.
Okay, well, I'm from Liverpool, England. My dad was a Liverpoolian from Liverpool, which is at that time was a big, rough city. And my mother was a farmer's daughter from Middle England. And they met in the war. My mum was in the Women's Army. My dad was in the Army in World War II. And it's through my mother's family that became involved in the countryside.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a little kid, my mum would put me on a train and send me 150 miles to the farm in my summer holidays. And I'd stay up there, and then I'd be watching foxhounds and things and that. And they'd meet at my grandma's farm. My mum's brothers all hunted. Everybody hunted. Some hunted on horseback, some done terrier work, some just followed them.
Yeah.
So, and people say to me, how do you come from Liverpool and get into fox hunting?
Because your dad wasn't a hunter, right?
No,
It all came from your mom's side.
I was raised in a big Irish Catholic community in Liverpool, and a rough area now, don't get me wrong. And my mum, as I say, was a farmer's daughter from Middle England, so I took after that side, you know.
Right, yeah.
Now, my brothers and sisters, I think they took after my dad's side. But me being the oldest, I took after that side.
So you started, your mom, did your mom send all the kids up there, or did she just send you up?
No, but me being the oldest, and I'd go there all summer holidays, like, and winter holidays as well.
Mm-hmm. How many brothers and sisters did you have?
I've got two brothers, two sisters. I lost a young brother, so I had three brothers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So there was six of us, six children, you know.
There's six kids in my family,
yes.
Too. So
well, we wasn't a big family in an Irish community.
Right.
There's a woman around the corner that had 21 kids.
I think my mom used to send me places, too. I think it was to get rid of me for a little bit, so she could only...
That probably my mom as well.
So tell me what it was like being a kid growing up in the city and jumping on a train and going 150 miles, and then, boom, you walk into this world with uncles that hunt.
Well, what can I say? I'd be there, and I just love the countryside, being out in it.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was a kid, I'd be snaring rabbits when I was 6 or 7 years old and messing around in the woods by myself. You know, you could do that them days.
Mm-hmm.
And you could put a kid on a train them days. You can't put a kid on a train nowadays.
What years would that have been, to give our listeners an idea?
It would have been about 1953, 54.
Mm-hmm.
When I was about 6 or 7 or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And so... Going from Liverpool, I've never been there, so I have no comparison. What's it compared to? Tell me what the comparison would be to a city like here in the United States.
Liverpool was a what can I say? It was a rough city, you know.
Size-wise, how big compared to a United States town or a city?
Well, say, big as, what, Charlotte or something like that. Maybe bigger, you know, or Charlotte. Bigger than that. Maybe Chicago, I don't know, you know.
Uh-huh.
But and Liverpool was a rough area. There's a lot of Irish people moved there. That's what I was raised in, you know,
mm-hmm.
in the Irish community, Irish Catholic community. But, I mean, it's got a better city now than what it was then days, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But then it was rough. I mean, when I was growing up, I seen kids with no shoes. You know, I was lucky. I might have had a pair of shoes on my feet.
Right.
You know, and
did you have to protect them, keep somebody else from taking them Liverpool?
Not so bad them days, but now you do. But, you know, that's it. Liverpoolians have got the name as a Scouser. And people say, how did you get the nickname of Scouser? Well, what Scouser is, whatever you had on a Sunday dinner, the leftover, the meat, would go in a pot on Monday, and that'd be on the cast iron stove all day cooking mm-hmm. with potatoes. And everybody in England, in Liverpool, had Scouse on a Monday because there was no money around them days. It was a poor city.
Yeah.
So that's how you got the nickname, a Scouser.
Okay.
And then people say, where are you from? I'm a Scouser. If you come from Liverpool, from London, you're a Cockney. If you come from Newcastle, you're a Geordie. You know, it's just a nickname.
Right.
That's how we got the name. And everybody in Liverpool had Scouse on a Monday. That was the leftovers.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't a very prosperous city in them days. I remember when I was a little kid, about 5 or 6, and I remember a woman taking one egg back to the local store because it was bad on a saucer. One egg. And that tells you how poor they was, you know.
Yeah, you need that egg.
Yeah, one egg.
Yeah, I need this egg. I need this egg. So you at 6 or 7, you start traveling, and you're going north, right?
East.
East?
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. And what kind of area would that have been?
It was all countryside.
Mm-hmm.
All farming community, little villages. The village my mum was born in, probably 15 houses there. But it was all countryside. So for a city boy, it was like, get out there, do what you want, you know what I mean?
Right.
No one to stop you.
Yeah.
You can do what you like. And then I'd be out there shooting wood pigeons and rabbits and hares when I was 8 or 9 years of age by myself, you know.
Yeah.
You couldn't do that in the city.
No. No. Did your uncles have hounds and terriers and things?
They had some of them had terriers, but they had horses as well, where they hunted with.
Mm-hmm.
But one of them done a bit of terrier work for the local pack of foxhounds. I think that's what made it tick him in me. That might have just clicked me that side, you know.
Yeah.
Because I'd see them be with them digging foxes out. And in them days, you could take a fox and send it somewhere else for the hunt the next day. You can't do that nowadays.
Catch the fox, put it.
And they'd be, say they were meeting 20 mile away, they'd take that fox and let it go
mm-hmm.
that morning. But you can't do that now.
Right, right. Let's talk about band stuff here in a few minutes, pre-ban. And because I know you refer to that a lot in your books about what happened pre-ban and post-ban and stuff like that. And we'll touch on that in a few minutes, but... let's break down the difference, because I've said this before on the podcast. I think a lot of times in the United States, there's only a handful of people that are hunters in the country here that understand the function and how a fox hunt was run, the value of the terrier, you know, the houndsman, you got the terrier man. And then let's just break down a fox hunt, a traditional fox hunt in England, when you got into it.
In what way?
Well, we don't know how they go. You know, I mean, you've got hound people, you've got terrier people. I want to talk about the difference. You worked as a terrier man for a number of years.
I mean, you've got the masters who more or less run the hunt,
mm-hmm.
and they put a lot of them put money into it and different things, and raise money and have functions to keep the hunt going. Then you've got the huntsman. He's more or less in charge of that kennel, and you probably have a whipper-in or two whipper-ins, and they're mostly young boys or girls, and they help him when he's out hunting in the field, keep hounds together and see different things and tell him what's going on. The terrier man.
Well, let's not move too quick here, because most of the time, even when I look at your pictures here, I see either you or someone else in a red coat with a lot of hounds around them. I saw a picture of you with beagles. Those beagles are all following you. They're not. When I was a kid, if we opened the kennel on the beagles, I mean, we were chasing beagles. They weren't following us. So talk to me about that part. I mean, how do you guys – you guys are moving these large packs of hounds down these roadways between the hedges, and they're going – you've got a good handle on those hounds.
Well, you're with them hounds 24 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
You're with them all day, every day, 7 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
So – they get used to you. It's like, I'm going back 25 years ago. I had some Americans came over and I was walking out with the hounds. They get to a crossroads and the hounds were probably 50 yards in front of me and they all stopped. And they said, how come they stopped? I said, because they know they're waiting for me to cross that road. I said, well, why did they do it? I said, because I'm with them and they know what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
And every one of them has got a name and they all know the name. And usually when you breed a pack of hounds, you'll name them after the sire or the dam.
Right.
And usually, not so much in America, but in England, the tradition is two syllables.
Mm-hmm.
So say you've got a hound called Bandsman or something like that, a dog hound. You'll name the pups like Banker and different things like that. And you usually name them the first two letters of the sire or the dam.
Mm-hmm.
So they all know the name. And it's just a way of life. You can't explain it. They know who you are, you know.
Yeah.
And they could be 500 yards away, and you shout the name, and they'll turn around and look at you.
So they could be on a full. Could they be on a hunt, and you could recall them off of a track?
Sometimes they're too they're dead set on getting it. And there's instances where, say you're beagling and you're hunting the hare, and they'll get away on a fox, and you're trying to stop them. You're supposed to blow a foul note, but some of them just don't take no notice to you. They want to be hunting and they're gone, you know what I mean?
You're supposed to blow a foul note because you're...
To stop them from hunting that foul thing, but...
All right. I recorded a short version of you doing this on our social media platforms, but you blew the horns. Tell us, I want to know how many different... recalls or sounds or calls do you have in a typical fox hunt?
There may be about four or five.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it'll be gone away, which is when the fox goes away, especially if you fox hunting, and the fox is gone. So you blow gone away, and then everybody knows that fox has gone away.
Does that mean after you set it to ground and you've bolted it?
Well, or... Unless you found it in the wood just there by itself.
Uh-huh.
You know, you're just in the woods with the hound next to me, gone away. And you blow gone away. So everybody in that field will know that note that fox is gone.
Mm-hmm.
And then if he's gone to ground, you'll blow a different note.
Okay.
You'll blow like three tunes, you know, like saying gone to ground.
Right.
So people know that the fox has gone to ground. Then it's going home at the end of the day, which is a big long note. You know, you're just playing on the horn, you know.
Mm-hmm.
This is another one, cross the ride. You know, when the fox has crossed the ride, with hound behind it, like in the middle of the woods, and people know he's going that way. It's just so many different notes on it, you know.
So as a huntsman, you're the one that's blowing that?
Yes.
How many people in the group would have a horn? Just one?
Just one. Now, some people will have, some will have them here, you know, but typically it's one man with one horn, and he's in charge of that foxhound. Then you'll have a field master. He's in charge of all the people.
Okay.
And he keeps them in check so they don't get in front of hounds and run over hounds and things like that.
Okay.
So, but the huntsman is typically in charge. The masters are the bosses, but he's in charge of that day, more or less. You know?
Okay.
And the terrier man and the whippervins listen to him. To what if he blows to ground, then he's calling for the terrier man.
Yeah.
So you need to get in there with the terrier and let him, ask him what he wants to do, whether he wants to bolt him, kill him. I mean, nowadays, if you put a fox to ground now, you put a terrier in, you've got to kill that fox. Mm-hmm. There's no such thing as bolting it now and hunting it again. That's a no-no now, you know.
Yeah.
But years ago, you'd kill a lot of foxes in the ground. And especially if it's on an estate where there's a lot of pheasants and the gamekeepers are there, mm-hmm. they want them dead.
Right.
So, I mean, you could have it in 10 minutes. You could be there 4 or 5 hours, but they want that fox dead, you know.
Yeah. So what time of day would you typically start the hunt?
About 10 o'clock, 10, 11 o'clock.
In the morning.
It's usually they meet at 11. That's the usual time.
Mm-hmm.
And not so much here. But in England, you go until dark.
Mm-hmm.
America's not that. They don't seem to stay out as long as what we do back home, you know.
We get started earlier, though.
Well, so do we. In Cubbon season, we'd be starting at 6 o'clock in the morning. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
but you finish earlier.
I'll tell you, one of the things out west is you've got to finish earlier.
Because of the heat?
Because of the wolves. If you go to the northwest.
Oh, yeah? Oh,
yeah, well, I know several people up there. It's like nothing. We're not turning out on any tracks after 2 o'clock. You know, if it's at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and we haven't got a track, it's time to go to the house because they just don't want their hounds out there running.
But it's
that late.
That's one thing. The fox hunting over here is different than England.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of boys over here from England and Ireland who try and keep it our way, but it's not the same. In England, we want to stay out.
Yeah, let's save that. I want to talk about the differences in England and in the States here in a few minutes. So did you start out in the fox hunt as a terrier man?
Well, no, I didn't. I left school when I was 15, and I worked on a construction site. But I've always had terriers and lurchers
mm-hmm.
from a young kid. And it was about...
What's the difference between a terrier and a lurcher?
Well, a lurcher is a sighthound, a greyhound cross.
Yeah.
You know, the terrier is... A terrier is bred more or less for earthwork.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really know, but England invented more terriers than any place in the world.
Yeah.
All these different terriers, Highland Terrier, Scottish Terrier, they're all invented in England.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's some come along the last 20 years or whatever. But I forgot what we were saying then.
Well, I asked you the difference. We want to do this like, you know, there are going to be people listening to this podcast that don't know anything about the lurcher versus the terrier.
Well,
so I asked
you asked
the
me about terrier. What happened when it's about 30 or maybe in the early 70s, mid-70s, I used to help a boy who was terrier man at a professional pack of foxhounds.
Mm-hmm.
And then a job came up in the south of England. I put in for it and I got it just by luck.
Mm-hmm.
That was 79. So I stayed there for a few years. And then I went to another pack in 83, which was one of the top packs in Great Britain at that time,
mm-hmm.
which is the Crawley and Horsham Foxhounds.
What was the name of it again?
The Crawley and Horsham.
Okay.
But they were probably six of the best years of my life.
Yeah.
To be a professional terrier man, you've got to be in touch with your huntsman all the time and tell him what's going on. And like the night before, I'd be out earth stopping till 2 o'clock in the morning. Blocking the holes up, especially the badger sets.
Okay.
And the next morning, I go out and check them again. So, and that's the way you get your runs. Because once you get a fox going, you find him in the woods, he's going to run to them holes. If he can't get in, he's got to keep going.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you get your hunts. And I think that the biggest hunt, the longest hunt we ever had was 11 miles as the crow flies.
Mm-hmm.
In a circle. And I was already digging a fox out for a gamekeeper. And when I got there, they said, we've run this fox about 11 miles. See if you can get him out. I bolted him again, and he'd done the same 11 miles.
So he did.
So that fox done 22 mile, and we lost him in the dark on a road. I don't how he got away. I don't know, but that was good. I like to see a fox get away.
Yeah. So
it's not all. It's not all about to kill him.
The terrier man. You would be in communication with your huntsman.
Yes.
And the day before the hunt, you would go out. Would you take your terriers out to find the dens?
You know where they are. You just know. You know where more or less everyone is, you know.
How do you know that? Just from experience of knowing?
Yes, because you've been there before or somebody's told you where they are. And sometimes you'd run a terrier through, make sure, and then block it up or something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But see, they've stopped all that now. You can't block it no more in England. But and then if you've seen a fox around somewhere or you bolted one, you tell your huntsman at the meet, a bolted one, there's one somewhere there. So we'd have an idea before they got there that there's a fox in that area.
Right.
So we'd be more or less ready, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that it's like you and the huntsman have got like telepathy between you, you know. And then that's good because he's looking for you and you're looking for him, you know.
That's one of the things that's intrigued me about the terrier is I am where I started to go with this when we started recording. One of the things I didn't understand was the relationship between the terrier man and the hound,
yes.
the houndsman or the huntsman in your case. Could you have a successful fox hunt without the terrier?
Oh, yes, depending on where you are.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, see, years and years, I'm going back even before my time. In the little villages and certain areas, you'd have, like, one or two guys or an old guy, and he was called an earth stopper. And he knew where all them badger sets was, and the night before, he'd block all them up.
Mm-hmm.
So the next little village, they have another one live there, and at the end of the season, you'd have an earth stoppers dinner for all them people who helped you out. See, sometimes the terrier man can't cover all that.
Yeah.
So you'd have an earth stopper. He wasn't employed by anybody, just a local guy, and he'd block all them holes up the night before and check them the next morning.
And he would do that because if he was a local guy.
Yeah, because you like fox hunting and that, yeah.
And because they didn't want the fox raiding the chickens. And
yeah, oh, yeah. Well, it's not only chickens, they kill so many lambs and that, you know what I mean?
There you go.
You know, I mean, there's nothing worse than a farmer getting up in the morning, walking in the field, and finding 10 lambs with their heads off.
And the fox would do that.
And the fox would do that and maybe take one. The same with the chicken. He'd get in there, kill 20, and maybe take one.
So would the fox be the apex predator over there?
Yes, that's all we got there. We don't have no coyotes, no wolves. Now you get a bad badger. You get a rogue badger would do things like that, you know.
Really?
Yeah, oh, yeah. Then you get a rogue, what you call a rogue, and he'd be in there, and he'd kill chickens and lambs, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But that's what I was saying before about the fell hounds in the Lake District and in Wales, where you've got a lot of sheep, and lamb is a big thing in England. And if a farmer got up in the morning and found 6 dead lambs, he'd call a hunt. So the next morning they'd go there with, say, 6 or 8 old hounds and drag up to where that fox is. He might be 2 miles away in the earth. And then you'd have to kill everything there, the cubs and everything. You don't like doing that, but it's got to be done.
Right.
That's a livelihood over there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So the farmers, a lot of farmers rely on the hounds.
Yeah.
You know, not so much in the flatland and things like that, but especially in the mountains and Scotland and Wales and things like that. They rely on them foxhounds to keep them foxes down.
Yeah. Yeah. How many foxes could you run in a day over there? How many would you catch? Could you catch in a day?
You might find none. You might find one. And
what's the most you've ever caught in a day on a hunt?
We caught 4.
4.
Yeah. But I've been out some mornings, what you call cubbing early morning, getting young hounds going. And I'm going back about 3 or 4 years ago. I counted 16 foxes in 2 hours.
And where was that at?
That was in the south of England.
Okay.
16. But, that country there was all grass and cattle.
Mm-hmm.
There was no shooting there. There was no pheasants. And so it was just a big hunting country. So they left the foxes alone.
Right.
We counted 16 in one morning in like 2 hours.
Yeah.
You know.
That's amazing. So what made you decide to write not one but two books about terriers?
Well, I got in 97, I was hunting a pack of beagles across the field, and I got smashed by a horse.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I got my leg broken. I've got no ligaments. It done me medial ligaments and my cruciates. So I was over there maybe 2 years later. This is before I moved to the States.
Mm-hmm.
And a woman said to me, from a local woman, she said, "Why don't you write a book on terriers, John?" I haven't got time to do things like that, you know. And she said, "Other people are doing this." She said, "You've got time now. You know, you can't work. You know, you can't walk." So I sat down and I wrote names of terrier lads I knew who'd been in there a long time, way before me. And I ended up with like 50 names in an hour.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'd done, I thought, what can I do with this? So I thought, I'll ask them all the same questions.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd call a guy and I'd go and see him. And all your terrier lads over there, they seem to know one another.
Right.
You know, but you all know one another in a certain area, uh-huh. You know, or you know he worked for this hunt and he worked for that hunt and this lad works terriers, you know. So I asked them all the same question. Everybody, you know, how long you been in it? What's your best dog? All this and that. And you know what? Oh, but nobody's got the same answer. They've all got different answers. And I thought, that's interesting because that makes it more interesting.
Right.
And different people like different terriers. Some like black dogs, some like white dogs, some like fell terriers, some like different types of terriers, you know. But everybody's got a different opinion. But that was the first one. And the first one, it became so popular that I was in England. I wrote it myself. I'd done 1,200. And I sold every one myself. Mm-hmm. I didn't sell them to a bookseller because I know they kill people, you know.
Yeah.
So what I'd done, I was at a game fair in England and a boy shouted at me. And he said, "John," he said, "I'd sold completely out 1,200. I sold them all around the world, South Africa, Germany. I'd get calls 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning."
Mm-hmm.
And I was at a game fair and a boy shouted at me. He said, "One of your books is just sold for £800. At that time, it was $1,200. I sold them books for $75.
Right.
I said, "You're joking." He said, "Honestly, John," he said, £800 on eBay or whatever it was. I couldn't believe that. So what I'd done to stop people making money like that, I reprinted it. And then I sold it to a bookseller. I sold them, I think it was 6 boxes or 4 boxes full. Well, he went and put the money up 6 times to what I sold it for. So I thought, well, that's never going to happen again.
Mm-hmm.
So then people were getting on to me. "Why don't you do another one? You missed so-and-so and so-and-so." Anyway, so I decided to do another one. Different people.
Mm-hmm.
I went to France. I went to a French game fair. I hunted guys in France. I interviewed guys in France. I went to Ireland. I stayed in Ireland 3 or 4 days, interviewed guys in Ireland. And I'd done another 60. And they've all got a different opinion. Everybody. And people keep saying to me, "Now, when are you going to do another one?" I said, "I can't do another one."
Sure you can.
You know, you keep going forever. But, I mean, I tried to do it. The two books, I tried to do it on lads who'd had terriers at least 20 years who were new.
Mm-hmm.
Some had them 40 years, 50 years, some had them 60 years, you know. But that's how I tried to do it because I thought the old people, the old terry men, seen a lot more than what we do nowadays. And they, especially with foxhounds,
mm-hmm.
and terrier work. Nowadays, I can't see terrier work carrying on in England the way it is, the way things are going over there. I honestly can't see fox hunting being in England in 20 years' time.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, you've got all these do-gooders in the city in concrete jungles moving to the countryside and telling people what to do.
Right.
You know, and they buy a plot of land or a little cottage with a backyard you couldn't swing a cat in, you know, and they think they own the old mountain.
It's the same way here.
It's worse over there now.
Well, it seems like that's a good message to put out there because those things find their way here. That culture finds its way here.
You're right. But they just think they own the whole place. And, you know, don't live in the countryside if you can't abide by the rules.
Right, right.
You know, stay in your concrete jungles. Don't come over here. We don't want you. You know what I mean?
Exactly, exactly. So in your books, how many different as I've read through your books, there's a lot of people that talk about Jack Russells and they talk about Fell Terriers. Those seem to be the two that you most see, people talk about. Some people are talking about Patterdales.
Well, when I was growing up, there was no Patterdales.
Okay, why not?
Patterdale is the name of a little village in the Lake District. Mm-hmm. That's where the Patterdale name came from. There was no such thing as a Patterdale. For what we know, it was just a black fell terrier. And then there was a guy in England called Brian Nuttall. He's in one of my books. Brian passed away about 2 months ago or something. Super guy. And we all credit, most of us credit him with inventing that Patterdale, which was what he invented, or what his stamp was smooth-coated with a little bully head on it, like a little bull terrier head on it.
Yeah.
Now, the Fell Terriers wasn't like that. The Fell Terriers have got a bit of a harsh coat to so they could cope with the weather on there, the rain, the snow and everything. Them smooth-coated ones, there was none of them when I was growing up.
Yeah.
I mean, I never seen a black terrier until maybe the mid-70s. And the black terrier, it was a smooth-coated one with a pointy nose.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, now they're everywhere. And people go, you know, crazy on Patterdales. I mean, don't get me wrong, I've dug with some good Patterdales, but I've never had one.
Yeah, you were talking about that.
I've had black terriers, but I've never had a good one.
There's a picture of you with a black terrier in that book.
Oh, yes, I know there is, yeah.
But you said it belonged to somebody else.
It belonged to me. But now I've dug some stuff with black terriers and good black terriers. I'm not knocking, no, colour doesn't come into it, you know what I mean?
I understand.
It's like hounds. I mean, I've got plot hounds. But colour doesn't come into it. A good dog is a good dog, no matter what colour it is.
That's exactly
right. You know,
it
could be pink with blue spots on it. It could be anything.
Right.
But I've always liked Fell Terriers and Russells. Good, you know, good Russells, not big ones.
Describe a Fell Terrier.
The Fell Terrier, to me, it belongs in the Lake District of England. That's where it comes from, more or less.
And it's F-E-L-L.
F-E-L-L-S, the Fells, yeah. They call them mountain, the Fells.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the huntsman, they call them Fell Huntsman. And nearly every Fell Huntsman has always got 2 or 4 terriers with him. Because when he's walking them mountains, he can't be shouting down to a road 2 miles away to bring a terrier.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll have them with him. And if a fox goes to the ground in a rock crag or something, he's there with his dog, so he's got them straight away. But the Fell Terrier, I've always liked the small one, 12 and a half inches.
Mm-hmm.
And they've always, most of them have got a nice harsh coat on them to cope with the weather.
Describe what a harsh coat is.
It's, what you say, like wire wool, you know, mm-hmm. what you call steel wool. A coat like that, and it's like got an undercoat to it, you know, so they can stand the weather a lot more than a smooth-coated dog can. You know, you get out and, say, rainy weather, real cold and sleety and that, and you've got a smooth dog, you'll see it shaking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and them Fell Terriers can stand a little bit more than that, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, I like a Russell with a good coat on it, a harsh coat. Don't get me wrong, we've got some smooth ones here, but they wouldn't be able to stand that weather over there.
Yeah, describe the weather. What was it? What was the weather like in the Fell?
The Lake District in England and Wales, mm-hmm. and Scotland. It can be snowing 1 minute, it can be hailstorming the next. It could be raining all day long, but you're out there with them hounds hunting, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And especially if you've got a bad fox that's killing lambs, that farmer wants that fox killing. So you're going to be there, hail, rain, snow, anything. 6 feet of snow, you're going to be out there. It makes no difference.
Yeah.
But, I mean, my... When I'd have a vacation in England or something, when I was Terrier Man, I'd go to Fells for a week or two because I just loved that kind of hunting on your feet, walking the mountains, you know.
Yeah, so it wasn't all... I think we have this picture of the traditional fox hunt where, you know, everybody's... I even thought, that everybody in the hunt wore a red jacket, and but we find now I've found out that only the huntsman's wearing the red jacket.
Well, and the whipper in, and some of the masters.
Okay.
So you know who they are, you know.
Yeah. But it's always done on horseback, but up in the Lakeland district.
The Lake District in Scotland and Wales, it's on foot. You couldn't ride a horse on them mountains.
Yeah.
You just couldn't do it. There's no way. So you're on your feet, and you'd be out there 4, 5, 6 hours some days.
Mm-hmm.
And you're on the mountains, and it gets cold and wet now.
So that brings me to this question. You have a lot of pictures of digs. and I'm not sure. I mean, that's one part of that I'm not real intrigued with because I've dug plenty of holes. So, but you terrier men seem to really set, and you even brag about, like, we did a 12-foot dig, or we did what's the biggest dig you were ever on?
16 feet.
16 feet, yeah. Down?
Yes. Now I've got a buddy in England. He got a terrier in a mine shaft, and he was down 30 feet.
Oh my goodness! And he was down on a mine shaft. So did he have to dig too? Was he digging?
He got down. He got a machine in the end to get down. But it's not. I remember being in the Lake District years ago with one of the fell packs, and we put a fox to ground in a rock crag. I was on the top of the crag, probably 50 feet high, and a guy there put two terriers in. And somebody shouted out, it made no difference. He said, there's already 14 there, never come out. You know, but, I mean, the guy just put, you just do that thing, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And some of them rock crags, you have to blast them out to get rescue the terriers.
I was amazed by that you guys were blasting.
Oh, yeah. But some of them digs have been a week. I know boys who stayed on a dig for a week. To rescue terriers, it's just a way of life back home.
Mm-hmm.
And you go out, and maybe three or four of you go out one day and have a big dig, 10 feet or something. That's what you go for. You go for the dig.
Yeah. We're going to have a dig. Let's go.
Yeah, if we're going out, especially years ago when you could dig the badgers, you know, yes, some bit. And some
that's
of them
one of the things that I saw you digging a lot of was badgers.
Some of them badger sets over there were 40 holes to them on a mountainside. They've been there since the Doomsday Book. They've been there that long.
Yeah.
You know, and people know them, but you go out to have a dig. That's what you go for. You know, you go out and have a 2-foot dig, it's not a good day.
So if you heard that somebody was digging terriers, did the other terrier men, like, go help and things like that?
If they had a terrier trapped in there. Now, before, I think the locator came out in about maybe 77, 78, the first locator, mm-hmm, with 8 foot. But before that, there was no locators. And you could dig badgers in them days. And some of them badger sets would be 10, 15 feet deep. And you'd get a terrier trapped, and people got to know of it. The next day, there'd be 10, 15 lads there. They wouldn't go to work. They'd go to rescue that terrier.
Mm-hmm.
And you stick together, you know what I mean?
So they would skip work to go help fellow terrier man.
Go to work, yeah.
Yeah.
You just get, but I mean, not only in the fellas, everywhere, you know, if it was a deer, if it was a rescue terrier, them lads would go out there and help them, you know.
Did I read something in one of your books that there was like a terrier rescue association?
The Fellow Marlin Working Terrier Club. And that was invented in the Lake District to rescue trapped terriers. That's how it started. Cyril Tyson was one of the first ones to get it going, him and a lot of terrier men in the Lake District, and they started the Fellow Marlin Terrier Club to rescue trapped terriers.
Hmm.
That terrier club's still going.
Yeah, because as I get this introduction into terriers and talk to different people, and they're talking about, you know, sending terriers under silo floors, you know, concrete silo floors here in the United States. And I'm thinking, how do you get your dog out of there? You know, and then I picked up your books and I'm reading your books, and you're sending these terriers under boulders. And I'm thinking, how are you going to dig that out? How do you get that terrier out?
You won't get it. Some of them rock piles, you won't get them out. And, some of them fell terriers, the good thing about them, they're like monkeys. they'll jump things and they put their back against a rock and climb up it, you know.
Yeah.
They're just made that way. They're just bred that way.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, some, you might be sitting there for 6 hours waiting for that terrier to come out. And a lot of the fell terriers, the good fell terriers now, they want that fox killing. So when that terrier goes in, he's going to kill that fox before he comes out.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd be sitting there waiting for it. It might be the next day. It might be the day after.
What's the longest you ever saw a terrier stay in the ground and come out?
Houndsman XP is very proud of our partnership with the organization Freedom Hunters. Freedom Hunters is a nonprofit organization that takes America's veterans hunting from field to field, from the battlefield to a field near you when you volunteer your time to take America's warriors hunting with you and your hounds. It's easy. Go to houndsmanxp.com, click on the partnership tab, and it will take you to Freedom Hunters. You can go direct to their website to make donations at freedomhunters.org. Support America's heroes. Let's pay it back. Visit Freedom Hunters at freedomhunters.org or go to houndsmanxp.com and you can find them on our website. From field to field.
I know one was in 7 days. I wasn't, that wasn't mine. I had one in, we put a fox to ground one night about 3 o'clock in the afternoon in a bank about 15 foot deep. And I couldn't even hear it. And it got dark on me, so I just blocked it up and left the coat there and one of the holes. I got a few lads the next day. We went back the next day. We opened it all up, the big face of it, opened about 8 holes, couldn't hear anything at all. So I thought, I think there were 4 of us. I said, I'll go to the police station and see if anybody found the terrier.
Mm-hmm.
I went there, they said, no, nobody. And when I got back the next afternoon, one of the boys said, I've heard the dog. He could hear the dog in the ground. So when we got on top of the bank, which is maybe 15 foot high, and listen, we could hear the dog about 4 to 5 feet down. So we opened it all up. And when we got there, the fox went past me and the terrier was right still with him.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd been in there 24 hours. So mm-hmm. I got him out. And somebody said, what are you going to do? I said, give me another terrier. We're going to kill this fox. It had to be killed. You know, it was on a big shooting estate. So we put another terrier in and put him in the truck.
Yeah.
But that 24 hours. But I know guys who's had 7 hours. 7 days, I mean.
7 days.
Yes. Yes, and 7 days.
The terrier doesn't always make it out, though, do they?
No. You know, not all of them. But that's part and parcel of terrier work, you know.
How does a terrier... I mean, how much does a fell terrier weigh?
Weigh?
Yeah, how much would it weigh?
Maybe 12 pounds, 13 pounds.
How much does a fox weigh?
16 pounds, 18 pounds, 20 pounds. Depends.
It's hard to imagine, you know, sending a dog in to confront a wild animal like that. And the dog would be successful. What makes them successful?
Some of them are so clever. They'll duck and dive with that fox or something.
But they're going in a little hole. How do they? Is it?
Well, they've been bred that many years for it. You know,
mm-hmm.
hundreds of years. And a lot of them fell terriers. You can go back to certain dogs 50 years ago, in that same line. And a lot of people, especially the fell huntsman, he'll have a line of terriers, and he will. And they'll go and use the good terrier off him, and he'll go and use a good terrier. They don't breed off terriers that don't work. They're not big show people now.
Mm-hmm.
And that boy on the front of my Facebook, a lad named John Jackson, he was master of the Melbeck Foxhound in the Lake District. And he had terriers. He's had terriers all his life. His dad had them before him. His wife had bought a terrier. This is just an instance. A beautiful looking dog and won all kinds of shows, but it never worked. People come to his house and said, I want to use your border terrier. He wouldn't let them use it. He said, what for? He said, well, I seen it win the show. He said, it doesn't work. You're not using it. And that's a fell man for you.
Yeah.
If they don't work, they don't use them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so some of them lines, you just go back years and years and years. And it's in them. But you watch some of them little them dogs, they're so clever, they know what to do. And when they get the chance, they'll probably get the fox by the throat and kill it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just the way, they just know, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not a terrier, so I don't know.
Man, I'm telling you, it's crazy, though, when I think about that. They're going in there, and that fox is already turned around. He's running into teeth, and the fox knows what's up. The terrier knows what's up.
What I find, it's not the size of the fox. I find that the little vixens have always given me a lot of trouble. The females.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you get big dog foxes, but them little vixens, they're like snakes, you know, so fast, snapping, yeah. You know. And I've always had more trouble with a little vixen than a big dog fox.
Yeah.
Always.
Have you on a dig, how many times have you dug down and the fox is still alive?
Oh, nearly a 9 out of 10.
Nine out of 10?
Yeah.
And so do you dispatch the fox at that point, or does the
terrier
become emboldened?
If that farmer or that shepherd wants to kill him, you kill that fox.
Mm-hmm.
Now, years ago, if it couldn't bolt when the terrier got to it and you dug it, you'd get it out and let it go.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully, the hound don't see it till it gets way away, and then you bring the hound back, you know.
Right.
And I think one of the best pack of foxhounds I ever seen on it was the Border Foxhounds in Scotland. And they put a fox to ground. They bolt that fox, but he'd take hounds a quarter of a mile away. And he'd just come strolling back to that earth. They didn't know where that fox was, and they'd pick it up and hunt that fox. And if one day I was talking to one of the masters, they hunted a fox 56 mile one day and never caught it.
Wow.
That one, now they was on quad bikes, four-wheelers.
Mm-hmm.
So them hounds must have done at least another third of that.
Mm-hmm.
And they were dragging up to that fox all day and never caught it. He said, but I will catch it. And I said to him, a guy called Michael Headley, I said, what's the most you caught? He said, I caught 11 one day with hounds. No, not dug.
Right.
Hounds caught them.
Mm-hmm.
There's no, he didn't dig any. He didn't kill anything in the ground. He always bolted them.
Wow.
He said, but I caught 11 one day.
How do you bolt a fox without... was he using terriers too?
Yes.
I thought maybe he was just, you know, running his hounds and somehow he was bolting without a terrier.
But some will bolt, but no.
Yeah, once they're in the ground.
Yeah, once they're in the ground. And they've been, hounds have been after them, you need a terrier to bolt them.
Yeah. No. It's just the whole thing, I never knew that I was going to be this fascinated with the traditional English fox. I just never knew it. I didn't know it, John, until I met you and started talking to you. And it's like, man, I thought I had a pretty good grasp on what was going on around the world with hounds. And then I start talking to you about this fox hunt and all the different working parts. And I'm like, man, this is a story that we need to talk about. We need to get this out here because I think that it's important for us to understand where our roots are, where this all got started, and you're to blame for it.
Well, they reckon these foxes over here in the beginning all came from England, don't they? The English fox hunters brought them over.
Mm-hmm.
Two fox hunt, you know.
Yeah.
So that's where they say it come from, you know. But speaking...
Why isn't the fox taken off and been so prolific in the United States like it is in... Is it other predators? What's your opinion on that? Because you would think that we would have, we're not going to see 15 or 16 foxes in two hours.
Well, you get a lot of trapping over here, don't you? That's mm-hmm. one thing. Then you've got the coyotes, you know. And coyotes will wipe a place out.
Right.
You know, not only rabbits and things, but they'll wipe the foxes out and everything, mm-hmm. you know. In England, not so much now, years ago, people, the gamekeepers, they'd saw foxes out, but they'd leave one or two for the hunt. So they could have a hunt. Nowadays,
you said gamekeeper.
Yeah, we have.
Explain what a gamekeeper is.
A gamekeeper in England, he might be working on, say, a private estate with a stately home and mm-hmm. the lord of the manor or something. It might be 3,000 acres, might be 10,000 acres, and he'd rear, say, so many pheasants a year. Now, when I had the beagles in Wales. The estate I lived on, was, I think it was 6,000 acres. He reared 125,000 pheasants a year.
Mm-hmm.
So he's called the gamekeeper. He'd rear them pheasants. And they'd probably shoot that place maybe 5 days a week. And I know on that estate, he was allowed to shoot 450 a day,
mm-hmm.
which is from 1st of October till the 1st of February. So 125,000 pheasants would be everywhere. He's got to rear them and feed them every day. And then when they let them out, they go wild after about maybe 2 or 3 months.
Yeah.
So they're everywhere. They're like chickens. They're all over the place, you mm-hmm. know. But they soon go wild. So the gamekeeper is in charge of that place.
Mm-hmm.
Looking after pheasants. It's like on the grouse moors in Scotland, they have somebody there looking after the grouse, and he looks after it, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know what you call them over here. I don't know. But
well, the gameskeepers were the precursors to the game wardens here in the United States. You know, was a gamekeeper in charge of making sure that people weren't coming in and poaching
off the
land and stuff like that?
Yeah, they haven't seen that.
Yeah, because like some of the breeds of dogs, like some breeds of dogs were used to detect poachers on the property, and it was a gamekeeper's job to go out and make sure that was taken care of. But they were wildlife managers on.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. See, we don't have game wardens in England.
Yeah.
Like you do here, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So on a big estate, the gamekeeper looks after that, and he's looking for people poaching anyway, you know. So,
mm-hmm.
What can I say?
So as the gamekeeper would go out there and he'd be managing the property and different things like that, he knew there was a value to. He didn't want a lot of foxes there. But he knew
them gamekeepers don't want any foxes there.
Okay, all right. But you said they might keep a couple for the fox hunt.
Well, yeah, they in the olden days, not so much now. See, you get a fox and he gets in a pheasant pen. I mean, once them pheasants are like maybe 6 weeks old, they put them in the wood in a big pen, maybe half acre, an acre, in a big, like 6 foot pen. If a fox gets in there, he can kill 50 a night.
Right.
Maybe just kill them. So they don't want that. That's their livelihood.
Yeah.
And their livelihood is people coming in to shoot. That's where they make the money.
Yeah. They're paying to be there to
hunt. They're paying to be there to shoot pheasants. It's a big thing in England.
Yeah.
It's not so much in here, but that's what it's like in England.
Mm-hmm.
So he's got to look after that estate. And they've got eyes in the back of their head. They're looking at everything, you know, watching everything, you know.
Yeah.
I suppose it's similar to a game warden here, you know.
Right, right. Yeah, there's another part of it, John. There's another part of it how it all works together. Tell us about, there's another part that you do that has really intrigued me too. You make walking sticks.
Well, I've been making them for 40 years.
What? And they're not just ordinary walking sticks. I'm going to get some pictures here before I leave of some of these amazing sticks that you're... Tell us about the tradition behind that walking stick in England. Because it's not the same as it is here.
No, it's not. You don't see people walking, say, in America with a walking stick.
Mm-hmm.
You go to England, go to these little villages, and you see people walking down the village with a dog. They'll have a walking stick. Or you go to a farmer's market. 90% of them people will have a stick.
Mm-hmm.
95%. It's like, what can I say? It, especially older people, it helps you when you know.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't like saying it, but it's like a third leg.
Right.
But everybody, nearly everybody has a stick, and you go to Fells and the Lake District, Wales, and people walking them mountains, even what you call ramblers, what you call, you know, the people walking.
Hikers.
Around, hikers.
Yeah.
They'll have a stick.
Yeah.
You know, it helps you getting up and down different things, you know.
Stream crossing.
Yeah, and I started making sticks probably 40 years ago, just as a hobby and different things, and... it just snowballed from there, you know.
But the pictures I see, we were looking through some albums here. Everybody's carrying one. Everybody carries.
That's right.
So is there's and you build them in different with different functions. Some of them are, you know, just like you've got shepherd's hooks, and I don't even know what you call all of them.
Well, you call them shepherd's crooks, some of them, leg cleeks. I put dog's heads on them.
Yeah.
It's just what people like, you know.
Mm-hmm. Was there a specific function? Was there a traditional function for the stick other than just walking? So if I've got a it seems like everything had a function at some point.
Well,
you
yeah,
know?
Because you look at some of them, what you call a shepherd's crook.
Mm-hmm.
A shepherd nearly always has one of them crooks.
Yeah.
If he wants to catch a sheep by the neck, he uses that stick.
Yeah.
So he hasn't got to run after it. He can lean in and catch it 6 to 8 feet away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or he'll have what you call a leg cleek, a smaller one, catch it by the back legs.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a tool to him.
Yeah.
You know, so that was nearly every shepherd you see on a mountain will have a stick, without a doubt.
Yeah.
You know, and everybody you see in the lake district walking will have a stick.
And the straight sticks or the hunting sticks, I mean, you showed me what you call the thumb stick. You know, where you, some of it's just, I think some of it's just because you want to look cool. You put that hook that thumb over that deer antler and lean against it and makes you look smarter.
No, if say you're house hunting and you're on the mountain and you got a fox to ground and say there's 6 or 8 of you, you'll sort of stand there leaning on that stick all talking. And that's helping you. You can't sit down on nowhere, you know what I mean?
So, yeah.
And to stand up, if you're standing and leaning on something, you're resting.
Yeah.
Think about it.
Absolutely.
You're resting on that stick.
It almost looks like if you're the guy without a stick, it's like, where the hell did this guy come from?
Oh, yeah, that's
from?
Right. Who's he?
Where'd he come from?
Yeah.
He's a rookie.
Yeah.
But they're exquisite. I mean, they're twisted. You've got twisted ash, and you've got what's the one that I bought from you, that I got from you? It's got the it's a pear of some sort.
Oh, a Bradford pear.
Okay, was it a Bradford?
Yeah,
or was it Carolina?
What it is, a Bradford pear is an invasive species,
right,
from China or Korea,
mm-hmm.
And a Carolina pear is the same, more or less the same thing.
Yeah,
but the Carolina pear, it grows with big spikes on it,
yeah,
2-inch spikes, and it's very similar to a blackthorn in England. Very similar,
yes.
And it looks like a blackthorn in England. And blackthorn, I would say, and fruit sticks are one of the best sticks to make a walking stick with. And if you know anything about Ireland, you know what a shillelagh is?
I've heard the name, but
shillelagh is like a club, but it's made out of a blackthorn. Mm-hmm. And all shillelaghs are made of the blackthorn. A blackthorn is such a nice wood, but this Carolina pear is very similar to it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a Bradford pear and a Carolina pear.
Yeah.
And I found that the best wood over there.
I mean,
I use a lot of maple. I might use a bit of chestnut or something than that, but that Carolina pear, if I can find them, they're the best.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love it. Yeah. It's people come in my house and they see it and they're like, "Where'd you get that?" It's got the deer antler.
Imagine
on top.
Them coming this house. There's 100
oh
in this
gosh.
House. They're everywhere.
You've been distracting me with. You should start showing me sticks, and I was just like, "Wow, look at this!" And I told you that you've kind of set me on a path here to collect some of the, a new. Obsession to collect some more of this stuff. I see, you know, with your collections of bronze statues of traditional, the fell hunter, that was a neat piece that you had there. But you travel around to different organizations or different events now, right?
Yeah, I do a lot of judging. I judge a lot of terrier shows.
Mm-hmm.
I've also judged hound shows, especially in England. But I just like going out and meeting people, and I know a lot of people, and the camaraderie, you know.
Yeah.
But I'm always out. If I'm not in the house, I'm up in my shed doing something, or I'm out with the dogs hunting.
Right.
Or
right.
I'm in the woods bear hunting.
Yeah, I had to.
Or pig hunting, or I'm out west line hunting. I've got to do something.
Yeah. And you've hunted all over the United States. You've killed. You've hunted mountain lions in the west.
Yes.
You bear hunt here on the coast. Where have you ever hunted in any other countries besides?
Hunted in South Africa.
South Africa? Yeah. What'd you hunt there?
Jackals.
Okay.
And with terriers in the ground.
No kidding.
Yes. And different things.
I guess I saw pictures of you in the book.
Yeah, but believe it or not, we dug porcupines in South Africa.
I don't even know why you would do that.
Well, they're not like these porcupines here. Them porcupines in South Africa got big quills, like 12 inches long.
Yeah.
And I remember the first time I put a terrier in, and the guy said to porcupine, I said, "How do you know?" He said, "Listen," and you could hear it shaking them quills.
Uh-huh.
Now, I've been in porcupines here with terriers and had to pack in hunting because they've got that many quills in them.
Yeah.
But it was different in South Africa, and we dug four in one day, in maybe 3 hours.
You're not pulling quills?
You're not pulling quills like you are here.
Hmm.
And I've got a buddy who lives in Pennsylvania. He had a little tiny Jack Russell, probably 12, 11 inches, and he pulled a coffee jar full out of that dog of porcupine quills.
Yeah.
I got into them twice and I said, "I don't like this. I don't like that." Because you got to stop it. You got to pack in, you know what I mean?
Right, right.
The worst thing I find out over here is skunks.
Mm-hmm.
They're the worst things ever. We've lost about 3 or 4 dogs to skunks.
I was going to talk to you about losing skunks or losing terriers on skunks.
I mean, you lose terriers in the ground back home. And people say, "What about?" I said, "It's a way of life, you know." But when you lose them over here to a skunk, which is what is as big as a squirrel, it just does your head in. You know what I mean?
How do they end up dying in the ground like that?
Well, if that dog goes in that skunk space and it doesn't come out, it's not going to come out.
Mm-hmm.
There's no danger. It's not going. What it does, it bends the lungs, it bends the eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had some narrow escapes. I think we've lost 3 or 4, but we've had a lot of narrow escapes.
Yeah.
Got there quick and got the dog out. You better get there as quick as you can, you know.
Yeah.
My wife and her girlfriends, and they'd go hunting, especially a few years ago. They had a truck and they had it rigged up because the three of them work for veterinarians. They'd have it rigged up with RVs and IVs and that.
Really?
Oh, yeah. We put everything in there. And I remember going to Tennessee years ago, 20 years ago, and we dug 8 skunks in 2 days. I said, "I'm not coming back here." And them boys over there, "What to do?" I said, "You go and get dog killed here."
Mm-hmm.
And they had the black dogs. And they were teaching the black dog, "Get in and kill it." I said, "They're going to lose dogs here." Well, 6 weeks later, they lost the dog. I said, "Because they're encouraging them."
Yeah.
You know,
does it just happen in the ground, or
it's all on top of the ground? It's okay, you know, you get away with it. But once it's in and the dog doesn't get out, and that skunk sprays here, I don't know what it does, but it burns the eyes, it burns the lungs, and we've dug down and found dogs just dead. It's just one of them things, you know.
Right, right.
That's terrier work now. And I tell people over here, you want to go hunting with terriers, you better be prepared for the worst to happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they're all like, and I'm not knocking the Jack Russell Club or anybody else. I said, but they all want these certificates on dogs. I said, you better be prepared because it's going to happen some days to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to dig down, it's going to be dead, or it's going to cave in on the dog or something and that, you know.
Yeah.
I said, but that skunk is the worst thing I've ever seen.
Yeah. So, tell me, we started to talk about this a few minutes ago, but talk about the differences between the fox hunt in England and the fox hunt here in the United States. You said it was different.
Over the years, they just seem to go out.
Besides the fact that we quit too early.
they seem to just want to go out and, what can I say, have a jolly or something. Now, not the English lad, but in England, you go out to catch the fox.
Mm-hmm.
That's that tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Over there, they don't want to catch a fox.
Okay.
And I'm going back. I came over in 88 first, and I was talking to people. I came back every other year or every year. And they don't want to catch the fox. They just want to go out and have a run around for 2 hours or something, and then they want to go home. In England, you go out to catch that fox and you stay out all day long.
Yeah.
You know, I've been to some meets, you start off with 80 or 100 riders.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the day, you might have two people left with the huntsman, the whipper in, and maybe a master or two, and there'll be two people left and you've had a good day.
Yeah.
But that's what people go out for in England. In America, they don't do that.
No, you're talking about a more of a, I'm going to put quotations around, traditional fox hunt here in the United States, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, you know, you go to the Midwest and you've got guys running coyote hounds and things like that.
That's different running coyotes now. That's different.
They're hardcore.
Yeah, that's different running coyotes. You know, you've got to kill them coyotes.
Mm-hmm.
And I admire them boys out there, you know.
Yeah.
And I mean, I was out with the Low Country Foxhound 2 years ago. And, you know, you've all got GPSs on your dogs here, you know.
Right.
They don't have that in England. And we ran a coyote for 2.5 hours and caught it after 41 mile on the GPSs. You know, that's good hunting.
Yeah.
You know, you probably wouldn't get that. I mean, I don't know whether you get that with a fox. You wouldn't get that with a fox over here, you know.
Right.
But, I mean, I understand you've got to kill a coyote, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't mean to distract us there. I just want to make sure we are, everybody that's listening to this, you're talking more traditional fox hunting clubs that are in the United States versus the fox hunt in England.
Yeah.
When you talk about the differences.
They don't seem to, what can I say? They don't seem to be, we like to go out and do it, you know what I mean? Yeah, they just don't.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'll take an instance last year. I went out with a pack of hounds. I won't tell you the year. Three people rolled up in a big truck with three horses. I came back to meet an hour later. They were gone home. I mean, it must have took them 2 hours to get ready, an hour to get there, go out for an hour. You might as well just ride down the field and do that.
Well, let me ask you this, because I don't know a thing about it here in the United States. But I can imagine that you've got a traditional fox hunting club and you've got a company, a corporate company that probably books a day of hunting there, and he invites his friends to come, his employees. We're going to have a company day at the fox hunt, and nobody, really the people that are there so that they can put on their jackets and get their picture taken, sitting on a horse and say they fox hunt.
Some people, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Because yes. Where are most of the fox hunting clubs here?
Where's most of them?
Yeah, they're up in Virginia.
Virginia, mostly, yeah.
Yeah, and what's close to Virginia? Washington, D.C.
Well, you probably
and, right. And so you get these
now,
people.
Now, there's a lot of serious people up there as well.
I agree.
Now, you know?
I agree. I'm just saying that. There's some kind of cool factor associated with it, and being able to get a picture taken and
yes.
Say, "Oh yes, you know, at their next business meeting, they can say, oh, we were fox hunting.'
Yeah, I've been
week.
Out with the fox hunt. I've been look up, at me. Yeah,
just got back in from a fox hunt. You know,
now there's a lot of serious lads in Virginia, and a lot of English lads who, and there's one or two American lads who aren't serious.
Yeah, and
know?
I'm not trying to. I'm yeah, just
yeah,
saying.
Yeah.
Saying,
yeah, I understand. Yeah. Yeah, I know that.
It's like. You know, the guy that goes out and shoots sporting clays and talks about his $5,000 shotgun.
Oh, yeah.
That if you took him out here in the woods and took him bird hunting, the guy with the old side-by-side shotgun that his grandpa owned, he'll outshoot him every day.
All day long.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's
but
interesting.
Right. It's like a tradition to say, oh, I've been out with the foxhounds and this and that, you know.
Mm-hmm. But I think it's important. I think it's a good thing that people are willing to go out and experience it. That way, even if they don't get a true, maybe the full picture or the true picture of it, at least they've been exposed to it.
Yeah, that's right. And they know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
It's not what you read in the local papers or
right.
See on TV about slaughtering this and slaughtering that. It's not all about that, you know.
Yeah.
And it is, you know. People think you just go out to slaughter things. You don't do that, you know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, fox hunters just don't go out just to slaughter things, you know what I mean?
Well, you were in England pre-ban, and you moved over here when?
98.
So the ban was in 95? or 96.
Something like that, yeah. They tried to ban it. They haven't really banned it. Mm-hmm. They think they have, you know. I think...
Well, give us the understanding of what that is.
I think what it was, it was the Labour government, like the Democrats, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, don't get me wrong, I'm not getting into politics, but a lot of the Labour people are townie people. Mm-hmm. So they don't know what's going on in the countryside.
More liberal, more progressive, more...
Yeah, you know, and they think, oh, them people with red coats, they're all snobs and all that. But they're not. Some people are miners, some people are labourers, some people work on construction sites. They're all different kinds of people. They think it's the hierarchy that's all these red coats. It's not like that, you know. And then they don't know what's going on because they don't see it. They don't. Mm-hmm. They never go and see it.
And when you say red coats, you're talking about the people that are, they see out there involved in the fox hunt.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they think, oh, look at them snobs. And that's what they're like.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, look at them snobs with red coats on. They think they own everything and all that. But it's not like that, you know.
Yeah.
You know, because everybody hunts in England. I mean, it doesn't matter who they are, you know. It could be a man standing walking down the streets or a guy standing on the corner selling newspapers. They all hunt, you know. It's not to do with snobbery.
Yeah.
But they claim it is, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that when they banned the fox hunting, there was a big march in London, two marches. And Tony Blair was the Prime Minister then. And when they had that big march, he got out of London. There was 400,000 people that day marching.
In support of hunting.
In support of hunting, yeah.
Yes.
And what's her name? Tony Blair got out the country, or got out the town, out of London. And they reckon there was 460,000 people. We reckon there was 1 million people in support of the countryside march and different things, you know.
Not March 1st, I'm holding a pen. Says, I was there, London, countryside march, March 1st, 1998. And then this is a more recent one. Says, I was there, London, countryside freedom, and that's 2002, September 22nd,
yeah.
2002. So if they didn't outlaw, what did they do? Because we hear the term pre-ban, post-ban thrown around. What was it? What really was it? What happened there? Can you move your mic back up? There you go.
They tried to ban fox hunting completely, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then they made a law that, I don't really know how it went, but they said you could go out with two hounds.
Okay.
So they actually messed up when they made the law, and they know they did, you know, because if you had two hounds and I had two hounds and they had two hounds, you got six hounds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but fox hunting's still going on in England the same way it is. I mean, you go out with a pack of hounds, there'd be 40 hounds there. So I don't know what they've achieved. They haven't achieved anything in fox.
Was it all for optics then? Was it just to make it look like that they were doing something when they really didn't have any intent of... Because when I talk to people, when I talk to some people from over there, you know, they talk about the oppression, like if you get caught doing certain things, you know... From our understanding, it's like all hunting has been outlawed. That's the message we get here in the United States. What's it like?
Now? They're keep bringing laws in. It's like 1983. I think it was 83. They stopped badger digging. And if you got caught badger digging, you got 6 months jail
for digging a badger.
For digging a badger. Now there was a lot of badgers them days, so that. A lot of people got out to terrier work because of that.
Mm-hmm.
And what can I say? Badgers since then have just exploded.
That's what I was going to ask.
Exploded. Next. I mean, millions of them now. There wasn't that many in it. There was a lot, but there wasn't as many because terrier lads kept them down. But now, what the deal is. Now, you can't go near the badger set. Now, you can't even fill a badger set in England. Say you're fox hunting the next day, and like we used to do years ago with and we'd go stopping here, stopping the night before. We'd put a bag in there or a load of branches and stop it. You can't go near them. You get caught interfering a badger set, you can go to jail.
What did you put in the hole?
Like a bag with soil in or a load of branches stuck together, you know, like twigs and that.
Okay.
And just fill it in. The end of the day, you come and take it back out. Just so he couldn't get in there. But you can't go near the badger set no more. You can't even touch them.
Why? Why would they be trying to protect the badger?
Know. And do you know what? The badgers cause more trouble in England than they cause TB. And especially
tuberculosis.
Yes, in the south of England and the West Country and that, you got a herd of cows, say 60, 80 dairy cows, and one's got TB, you destroy that whole herd.
That's the way it is.
You've got to start again. But badgers, what can I say? They put it around because they lift the cow pats up looking for worms and that. So they give the cows the TB. But you can't tell these people in cities and that about that. They just don't believe it. They think like, it's like the foxes now. The towns in England are absolutely overrun with foxes. Overrun with them. They call them dustbin foxes. They're in the dustbins of a night time, outside the fish and chip shops and that.
Dustpan?
Dustbin. The dustbins.
Oh, dustbin.
Yeah, what
do
you call them? Trash cans, you call them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they live on...
I wasn't picking up on the...
The dustbin. They call them dustbin foxes. And you go in the likes of London, Birmingham, Liverpool, all big cities, and you drive through for night time, you guarantee you see foxes. They're crossing in between that. I remember one... I'm going back... 35 years. And Birmingham, I never seen as many foxes in my life. And Birmingham's a big city now. Mm-hmm. It's as big as London, a big city. I never seen as many foxes in my life in a city as them.
Wow. What year was that?
About 35 years ago, something like that. 30 years ago. I never seen as many foxes. And I've got a buddy there, a good terrier man. He had 9 calls to go to one Sunday morning to move litters of cubs out of backyards, people's gardens.
Wow.
There was everywhere. And I remember Sunday morning, we'd be fox hunting on the side of the river or the railroad or something. And there was a soccer match going on, and we bolted a fox. He went through the soccer match with the terriers behind him on a Sunday morning and then started running down a 4-lane highway with the terriers barking behind him. This is in the town. But they are everywhere now, foxes in the towns. I mean, in the countryside, because of all these high-powered rifles and night sights and things like that, people are just destroying the wildlife in the countryside.
Yeah.
You know, foxes are just shooting them everywhere. But the badgers have exploded in England.
Can you still shoot a badger in England?
No, you can't go near them. You can't touch a badger. And
I wonder why they picked that animal to do
black
that.
And
that
white, nice black and white things look nice. They don't know nothing about them. And I remember years ago in the south of England, going down country lanes, and there'd be a slab of concrete in the road, probably 20 foot by 30 foot. And what it was, the badger sets would be running underneath there. That's so the badgers wouldn't get run over. The tax people are paying for that. People are paying for to look after them. And they cause TB. They're a pest.
Wow. Not to mention the fact that a badger can flat excavate some earth.
Oh, and, without a doubt. As I was saying before, some of them badger sets have been there since the Doomsday Book. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and then they trying to run cattle in that area, and they're taking up pasture and grass.
I've seen tractors turn over in the field because of a badger set.
Right.
You've gone down a hole. But
yeah.
You can't tell these people, you know.
Right. Well, John, man, I'm thankful that you did this with us and talked to us. I'm not kidding. I've been looking forward to trying to get this set up with you since I met you in Somerset. And I hope you'll talk to us again.
No, well, thank you.
Yeah, maybe when we're in Texas in October or, you know, sometime, we can get together and talk again. Talk about some more stuff. Talk about your hound hunting and stuff like that.
Yeah, I'm not the big guru now. There's a lot of boys out there way better than I've ever been. Ever will be, you know.
Yeah.
Ever.
So do you have a website for your wares, your sticks, and
No,
your
I haven't, but I'm going to get one going.
Okay. Yeah. So how do people find your book, Terriers and Terrier Men 1 and 2.
A lot of people know who I am, you know. I don't mean in a big way, in a big-headed way, you know. But once they find you, they know where you are. They'll find you.
Yeah,
without a doubt, yeah.
Yeah. What about your walking sticks and such?
The same thing. People wear the mouth, you know.
Okay. All right. Well,
plus, I've had somebody done a magazine on me, eight-page magazine, and then the local TV station done a thing on me years ago. So people know, they get to know you.
Yeah.
And I'm not the best stick maker around either.
But they're beautiful. Yeah.
The stick makers in England, I couldn't lace their boots, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Honestly. Yeah, and the people wrote books and I couldn't lace their boots, you know, way better than I'll ever be.
Well, people need to find you. The name of your little business is The Poacher's Pocket.
Yeah.
And you can't find it anywhere on the internet, so you're going to have to come down here to North Carolina and find you.
Or call me.
Yeah, or call you. So that'll do it, John. I appreciate it.
Thank you for doing it.
I really do appreciate it.
That will do it for this week on the Houndsman XP Podcast. You can find John Broadhurst's book, Terrier Men and Terriers, on Amazon. I'm telling you, they're coffee table quality books, folks, that you're going to want to have on your shelf. They are collector's items. Also, if you have not done so, please, 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 if you enjoy our content, go to Apple Podcasts and leave us a review. We need some new reviews over there. Also, don't forget to log your time listening to the Houndsman XP Podcast on Go Wild. You've got a few more days to get your name in the hat for the drawing of the Dakota 283 G3 Medium Kennel. Every time you log an episode that you listen to this podcast, your name goes in the hat, and that goes until the end of June. So go to Go Wild, log your time. Till next time, you follow your hounds, and I'll follow mine.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.